We are back after Thanksgiving, 15 and 60 on the Eastern Conference, doing it all in one go here. We're sponsored today by Helix Sleep, the most comfortable mattress that I have ever owned. HelixSleep.com/capspace is the URL to get $50 off your custom-made mattress. And then also our old friends at SeatGeek, use that capspace code in the promo section of the settings tab to get a $20 rebate off of your first SeatGeek purchase. Let's get started with the Washington Wizards. Where I wanted to start with them is they're at 5-10, 3-3, 538. Our old friends, we're going to use these. Got a lot of old friends on this show, apparently, and a lot of old verbal crutches to use as well. 31% chance of the playoffs for the Wizards. Do you think that over or understates their chances?
Understates it slightly because they have more talent than the teams that are around them, but they're also, 5-10. They have to go pretty far in order to do it, but I still do like their talent better than the non-playoff teams in the East. So I'll say it's, maybe more in the 40% range.
So 538 says that the eighth team in the East is going to be the Indiana Pacers, currently projected with a 36-46 record. And they are listed at a 43% chance of the playoffs. Wizards projected at 34-48, 31% chance of the playoffs. None of these teams really are scaring me when we're talking about the eighth seed, and maybe even the seventh seed as well. You got Wizards, Bucks are in the mix there. Even Miami at 5-11, I would still put in the mix there a little bit. And then Knicks and Pacers, I think then there, I would put a little bit of a line of demarcation between them and say the Hawks and Pistons, even though Pistons have a losing record. I think if they get Reggie Jackson back, that's really going to help them a lot. So I don't know. I might still say that it's a little bit higher than that, but they are going to have to kind of get it together. And I think there's a way to do that because, as you noted, they're 16th in offense, which I think is actually solid for this group, but only 24th in defense. And I think they've shown the ability to improve in that area.
Getting Jan Mahinmi back will certainly help too, because that can give them more of a defensive identity on that second unit than Jason Smith has provided so far. And something that I noticed doing a little bit with the synergy stuff, and we've talked about it, but one of the classifications that I think is really useful is transition frequency, because that's just what percentage a team uses there. And the Wizards are yielding the second worst, so highest, opponent transition frequency in the Eastern Conference, 26th overall. That is something they should be doing better, particularly because it's not like they're playing beast offensive rebounders at the four.
Yeah, that's true. And Markieff Morris has had a disappointing season so far. I think that they actually should be very happy with what they're getting offensively from Beal, Wall, Porter, and Gortat, all players who are above where they've been from an efficiency standpoint. I think Gortat, especially because he's playing so many minutes, has been not really the defender that he used to be. And, I think getting Mahinmi back might really help that. They still have the rest of the bench, though, that is just an enormous problem on this squad. I mean, you have Marcus Thornton, 286 minutes so far. I think he might have played the most minutes so far of anybody off their bench. Is that right? Yeah, that's right. Negative 13 net rating. He has not been an NBA rotation player for several seasons already. Really, the only guy they've gotten any production from off the bench to date is Satoransky.
Satoransky has done some nice things, and having somebody who can run the offense and not necessarily guard point guards is a huge tactical advantage, but not one that they've really used too much. Partially because Satoransky is this weird kind of tweener guy, but Trey Burke has been a big problem for them. Nicholson has disappointed. Nicholson and Smith both have had their shaky moments in terms of even being in the rotation in the first place, and so they just don't have enough guys to throw at it. And it'd be great if somebody like Sheldon McClellan or House could get in that mix, but they haven't really shown any real push to make it there. And Oubre, I've never been a big fan of his. I'm still not a big fan of his.
Yeah, he certainly is not there for an efficiency standpoint or based on what he's doing executing the system defensively. Is it time to admit that the Andrew Nicholson signing was a mistake? I mean, we always felt the Jason Smith signing was a mistake. Nicholson, I think we liked a little bit more, but he has been really a train wreck so far on both ends of the court. It's not looking good. Were we just wrong about him, or is it too early to say still?
I never liked the years. I thought the money per year was fine. I still think the money per year was fine on like a 2 or maybe even a 3 year deal, just because they didn't have much flexibility and they weren't going to get anybody else. But giving him 4, yeah, that I think we can say at this point that it's more likely than not that will be a mistake.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see who they're bidding against there, because as you recall, he actually had his qualifying offer pulled by the Magic when they made their signings.
One of the last guys that may ever have that.
Yeah. I can't remember whether they pulled it or they never made one to begin with.
They might not have made one to begin with him. I can't remember.
And again, that could have been at the request, doing him a favor as well, since they knew that he wasn't going to be in their plans. The other issue that has been a big one with Scott Brooks going back to the Westbrook Durant days is not staggering his stars. Billy Donovan finally got Westbrook and Durant to do that last year. I think that really helped them. He has not been staggering Wall and Beal thus far. I think that has contributed a lot to the terrible production they've gotten off the bench from guys like Burke and Smith and Nicholson, etc. But the other side of the coin is they always sucked when Beal was on the floor without Wall anyway these last few years. So there's not necessarily a reason to believe that that's going to work any better. And maybe you just got to cut your losses with the bench and still be good with the starters.
There is more symbiosis between Wall and Beal than between Westbrook and Durant, who really got their own. And that's why the stagger there made so much sense. It's an important facet of the idea of a stagger, is how well do those pieces fit together. And the second point you brought up is extremely important, which is that Beal, if he is not enough to carry the second unit, then you're really wasting his minutes. However, I would like to see Beal Satoransky a little bit more, because they can each kind of float between the guard positions. You probably have enough ball handling there, and so if you put them with a capable third guy, and now having defense from Mihimi Gortat, whoever they're going to have in at that moment, that could be enough, and I think they should try it, but they should also have a relatively quick hook on it, because if it doesn't work, then you're really hurting your starters because they don't have a Beal replacement.
So I wanted to read one thing from Trey Burke's stat line. He's shooting 0% at the rim and shooting above 50% both on long twos and from three-point range, which is pretty remarkable. And he's had some bad turnover games. They've been awful with him on the floor. I still think that there's a greater chance of him playing well at some point than Thornton, who we know isn't going to be any good. Playing he and Satoransky together might help. Maybe you play Burke off the ball to try to get a little bit of shooting. I think that Satoransky, he's been doing pretty much everything within 10 feet. He is not a good jump shooter, certainly not from NBA 3. So the Magic may run out on him. He does have the best net rating on the team among the rotation players right now at 4.5 as of a couple of days ago. So I don't know. I there don't seem to be any great answers. They've been trying to play Markieff Morris some with the bench. That hasn't really worked much either to get a little bit more offense. So I'm not sure necessarily where it comes from. Maybe you just try to play Kelly Oubre at the four and just get enough spacing that you can get something out of these more limited offensive players with Mihimi at the five. You hope the defense holds up. There are things you can try, but I don't like any of those options in particular.
No, I don't either. And it's a challenge that they're going to have to do, because this is a point in the year where it's very hard to find guys kind of out of the scrap heap who can contribute and make your team better right away. You might be able to find a long-term contributor, but finding somebody who will be, you know, a centerpiece even on a bench unit is hard.
So before we move on to Toronto, I want to tell you about Helix Sleep, one of the first sponsors that I actually sought out. I found them because I ordered from another one of these mattress delivery companies that's basically one size fits all, and I was not part of that all, apparently, because it did not fit me. Both my girlfriend and I suffered from some back pain after we got it, so we had to utilize the return policy and return it. And so she decided to find Helix Sleep. We wanted something that would fit us a little bit better, and Helix Sleep, you fill out a 2 to 3 minute questionnaire and they'll customize the mattress for you. You can get a blend depending on how hot or cold you like to sleep, the firmness of your mattress, body size, side sleeper, back sleeper, all that stuff. They'll customize it for you. They can also just put a split in there too, between you and your significant other's side, if your preferences deviate a little bit. And both of us agree it's the most comfortable mattress that we've owned. Our California King was a little over $1,000. You can get a twin starting at $600. They go up from there. And that's way cheaper than you're going to find at some of the mattress stores. And especially at a mattress store, you're not going to know whether it's comfortable anyway. What are you going to lay on it for 10 minutes and then take it home? Like, you can't tell anything in that 10 minutes when you awkwardly lay on it in the store with your shoes still on, not sure whether you're allowed to put your shoes on that bedspread that they have on at the store. It's really a weird process. So this is much better. You can try it risk-free for 100 days, and it's customized to you. The way way to get started with them. HelixSleep.com/capspace is that URL. Don't forget about that slash capspace URL, because A, that lets them know that you came from us. B, gives you a $50 discount as well. So give it a shot. I think it is, you have nothing to lose whatsoever because of that 100-day return policy. I think it's the best mattress I've ever had. I hope that you will agree. HelixSleep.com/capspace. I feel like I'm running out of things to say about Toronto. You know, they are 10-6, 3-4 since we last checked in on them. 99% chance at the playoffs and fourth in offense. I guess the biggest place to start here is just that their defense has not been very good, but I just, yeah, all right, I think they're going to be pretty good. They'll get to the second round if they get a favorable matchup. Maybe they'll even get to the finals. They're not really a threat. I don't know what else to say about them, but maybe you can enlighten me.
I'm excited to see whether they can utilize Pascal Siakam to be something a little bit more than they've done, just because
in like 2018.
Yeah, that's true. it is an issue, and they're in this also in this strange holding pattern because Boston started out the season with so many injuries that we can't even play the game of, oh, well, who's, you know, are they better than Boston? Because we haven't seen the Celtics team for very long.
Well, we can play the game of who is the second best team in the East, which you remember was quite a fun parlor game for us last year, because every time I pronounce someone the second best team in the East last year, they immediately went into a massive tailspin. It was looking like the Hawks, they have gone on a Western trip, have come on some harder times after their 8-2 start. Who's your opinion? Who is the second best team in the East?
The Raptors for right now. They're there, and I believe it will be Boston if they can stay full strength by the end of the season, but they weren't when they were missing all their good players, so you can't say they're the second best right now.
Yeah, I guess if you had to say, all right, there's going to be a 7-game series that starts tomorrow between all those teams, you would maybe pick Toronto, I think. But
I'd probably still pick Boston, but that's just because I like their talent. I like their team better.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about them too. I think for Toronto, they do have some issues that we should discuss. Some familiar. One of them is that DeMar DeRozan, crazy mid-range shooting. He has regressed a little bit. Now, on the season, still at 47.4% for mid-range and 48.9% from inside the lane, outside the restricted area. But over his last 7 games, shooting only 43% overall, 52% true shooting, -0.3 net rating, and he's down to 41% on those long twos and then 36% inside the paint, not restricted area, and he's been shooting poorly from three-point range all season. So basically over those last 7, he's gone back to being kind of the guy he was last year. You know, relatively, he's still getting to the line a ton. I think that includes that Warriors game where he was like 17 for 17. And the other thing is that they just still are not that effective with him on the floor compared to the units that only have Kyle Lowry.
Lowry is having another very good season, and part of what makes him special is that he can work with a wide variety of players. It's part of the reason I like him so much. And so one of the things that you found was that Lowry plus bench units with Noguera are plus 34 in 64 minutes. And yeah, those lineups are largely going against second units. That's a part of this.
Yeah. But, and to be clear, that's plus 34 points in 64 minutes. Yes.
Not net rating, plus 34.
Yeah, I've made that when we're talking about like pretty small samples, now I'm trying to just say the number of points and the number of minutes just to make it clear that, you know, it's been a small trend that has existed, not necessarily going to continue, but just to kind of say what will happen.
Yeah, we'll use net rating when we're saying net rating.
Yeah. All right, fair enough.
And then DeRozan with the bench, it's only happened really 33 minutes, and they've been outscored by 23 points during that time.
Yeah, another thing too is that their starters suck again. And last year it was Scola in there, just not their best guy, -0.9 rating so far. This year again with Siakam in the 160 minutes, by far their most used lineups. So they have been outscored by 13 points in that time. And then you throw in Patrick Patterson instead of Siakam, they are now plus 28 in 55 minutes when Patrick plays. And once again, I think you're going to get into the same situation in the playoffs where all of a sudden you're starting every game down by 10 in the first 6 minutes, and they're going to want to start Patterson. And then he hasn't started all year, and you're wondering, oh, hey, why can't he start? You know, he has this weird thing where he has to come off the bench, he can't play effectively. Just start the guy. He's your best player, even though he's been shooting so poorly so far this year. I think I looked at it last week, and he was shooting 25% on wide open threes so far this year. I think he's going to improve there. He's never been that pure of a shooter, because you think he's missed a fair number of wide open shots in the playoffs, but enough that you have to guard him there. Just start your best lineup. get that lineup out there. And then if you want to play him in that Lowry plus bench unit, you can still take him out 6 minutes into the game and then bring him back with Lowry again.
Two other things about their rotation that I would like to see. One is making sure that Valanciunas gets time when Lowry's not on the floor. Just give him more touches, feed him. They don't really have an offensive identity necessarily. It's not saying they play badly without Lowry on the floor because they have Corey Joseph, but it'd be a nice time to really get him in rhythm. And also just even trying, I'm not going to say, oh, start it full time, trying Carroll at the four and Powell at the three, or even if Ross, if they felt like that was better for some reason, to see if it works. Because against certain opponents, especially teams that play, let's say, non-traditional fours, I feel like that would do reasonably well.
You think there's any chance that they just would play better with Bebe versus Valanciunas at center, or is he not the type of player that Biombo was last year?
I don't think he's as good defensively, and you can't, he doesn't have that kind of motor where it's just like Biombo, it's like, okay, I know what I do well, I know what I don't do well, I'm just gonna go full bore at that. Noguera is good, but I would like to see it just to make sure. Like, with all these things, you know, there are kind of theories that are in the air, and until we know, we're just kind of speculating, so why not?
Bebe is better than Biombo is offensively. I think he is better at catching, can get up for some alley-oops a little bit more. But yeah, on the defensive glass, on the offensive glass, his intensity, his ability to switch defensively. You remember last year in the playoffs, they actually had Biombo when LeBron James would try to post up. Biombo would actually get the defender out of there and just defend LeBron one-on-one. They actually had some success with that tactic on occasion. Bebe, definitely more of a space cadet defensively than Biombo. Not as good of a post defender either. He can get beat up in the post. I think he can be effective for them, but yeah, it's tough because when you go against Cleveland, maybe even when you go against Boston, the shooting that those teams have at the big position is going to be a difficult matchup for any of the centers that they have in the roster, really.
It's a good point.
99% chance of the playoffs for these guys, 20% chance at the number one seed, amazingly, and 7% chance at the NBA title. Both of those latter two numbers seem high to me.
Yes, especially the last of those.
And Cleveland, I mean, has their defense hasn't been that good. We'll talk more about them, obviously. But they've been dominating. They've been kind of coasting through a lot of these. I mean, they won by four today at Philly, in a game where they kind of, it was early in the morning and they weren't really trying that hard and they still won. They've had a lot of those games and they've had some dominating performances. I would be shocked if Cleveland doesn't get the number one seed.
Unless somebody key misses a lot of time. And that's priced into the 20%.
Who's next here?
The Philadelphia 76ers, 4-13, 3-5 since the last time we did this. Unsurprisingly, 30th in offense. Somewhat surprisingly, 19th in defense. Maybe even more surprisingly good.
Good or bad, yeah.
I mean, they've had some good moments. And then a 2% chance at the playoffs. Hey!
Oh, 19th in defense. Embiid has been fantastic. You know, he has, like, I think, like a 9% block percentage. Covington is a good defender. Henderson, that's a good starting wings defensively. I think that's an above average. McConnell can defend reasonably well at point guard. Rodriguez obviously is a sieve. Stauskas is. Ilyasova can be okay at times. At least he'll execute the system, likes to take charges. Not bad on the glass. Embiid obviously good on the glass. And then, you've got Holmes and Okafor, neither of whom are much defensively. But getting to Okafor, I was just perusing some of the league leaders and saw that a couple of days ago, Okafor was 11th in block percentage. So I went through and watched all of his blocks, thinking that, because my thought is, been he's not as hopeless as your Cantor type, as your Greg Monroe type, because he does have that 7'5 wingspan, and he actually has been getting some of these blocks in impressive fashion, getting them without jumping, kind of Tim Duncan style. He's got quick hands, he can get his hands in. He's not really getting in front of drivers pretty well, but if they're sort of going up next to him, he can reach out and knock it away if you're putting the ball up near him. He did have one block where he kind of skied to block a Lavoie Allen dunk. He was also given a couple of those in rather speculative fashion by the scorekeeper. But this isn't to say that he is like a good player now defending the rim. He's still giving up 51% shooting at the rim, which is below average for a big, but at least some progress. He's showing the ability to do something, and he's still on a lot of these blocks. He's late. He's not getting his chest in front of guys. That's really where I think he could be effective if he could ever lock in to that level, because he has both the length. If he just goes straight up, he's got that big body. Guys are going to bounce off him in the air. So I'm not saying he's any good yet, but slightly encouraging at least that he's there. And then so the other rim protection stats for their centers, Holmes, despite his shot blocking, he's only at about 50%. And that makes sense because a lot of his shots, he just kind of comes out of nowhere, gets him in the air. He's not necessarily in position as often.
He's not and then, stout.
Yeah, that's true too. Guys can kind of bounce off him a little bit. But Embiid, they are shooting terribly, and they've been much better defensively when he's been in the game, shooting only 42.5%, which is like leading Rudy Gobert, Andrew Bogut type of level.
My thought on Okafor so far this year, and I admittedly regret, or I get sad basically every time he's in the game because it means Joel Embiid is not, is that he has confirmed, at least at this point in his career, and guys can grow a lot from where he is, he's still young, that he is more of a backup than a starter, but he could be a very good backup in time. Like, I think that some of his flaws can be corrected, and it might never mold. Maybe this is sort of like Kanter, where it'll never mold into the way where you're sitting there going, oh man, even he's above league average as a starting center, but there is an intense value to being one of the five best backup centers in the league, especially if he can get to that point while still on this rookie deal.
His shooting, I think, is instructive. He's shooting 63% at the rim, which is not quite as good as it had been, but still above average. Very nice percentage in the lane as well on these post-ups, 21 out of 43. And then outside of the paint, 3 out of 24. He just needs to cut that shit out. And now he's got a lot of situations where he just has to create offense. He has to turn and face. There's a double team. There's not anybody else on this 30th ranked offense who can create still. But if he's on a real team and he can just, you know, all right, we're not going to throw you the ball, Jahlil, when you're 20 feet from the basket with your back to the basket. I actually like him attacking off the dribble from the top of the key. That's something that he does well against opposing centers. But just tell him, hey, you know what? You're not allowed to shoot outside of the paint. And if you're strong enough to either back down, and if you can't get the shot off at that point, it's because you're getting double teamed, and then make a pass. And they don't have quite that level of creation around him. But if he could just get rid of those shots, and he's been a lot less efficient too this year because he hasn't been hitting from the free throw line. But if he gets rid of those, then he's a really efficient offensive player. His free throw rate will go up as well because you're not getting fouled when you're shooting a jump shot outside of the paint. So it'll be interesting to see. Like, I'm not ready to give up on him yet as like a quality starting center. I do think it's probably more likely, even if it's only due to the perception, that he might turn into Cantor, who, by the way, was another number three pick in what seems like a bygone era now that he could be a number three pick after not playing a single second at Kentucky. But yeah, I don't know. What else you got to say about these guys? I've rambled on long enough here.
Something that is legitimately concerning about Okafor is that he is not rebounding, and that is even more concerning because last year he played some of those misguided minutes with Nerlens, and so you could say, oh, you know, they're playing two bigs, those guys are stealing from each other, but he dropped from, I think it's from like 14%, depending on which measure you're using. So he had a 13% overall rebound percentage last year. I'm using Basketball Reference, their different numbers. He's at 9.1 on their numbers for this year, and that drop is mostly on the defensive glass, and now he's not playing usually with a traditional center.
Yeah, and not even necessarily playing with any type of traditional big next to him. Nick Stauskas, however, actually has been good. We had speculated, probably even advised, that he get his rookie option declined, but when you're in the cap position that a team like Philly is, you might as well just hold on to him and see if he breaks out. And hey, he actually has looked pretty good. He's hitting his shots. He's at over 65% true shooting. The biggest thing that he needed to do is actually make his shots. He made him for the Canadian national team. He made him in college, and now his confidence is a little higher. Still getting steamrolled defensively, of course. On the opposite end of the spectrum is Robert Covington. I looked at it a couple of days ago. He was fourth in the number of catch and shoot threes per game that he's taking at 5.7, and he's hitting 23% on those. So that's he's too good of a shooter for that to continue, though.
He's had some nice defensive performances though too, and I still like Covington. I believe that he'll turn it around. And something else that I noticed as I was combing a little bit through some things is that Philly has, as in terms of frequency, has done the second most post ups, but their points per possession is just 0.76, and there's a weird parallel there. Well, not weird, with the Pistons. The Pistons do a lot of post-ups for Andre Drummond, even though they aren't that good, just because it keeps him happy and everything else. So maybe it's an acceptable loss within this, but when you're the 30th offense, maybe you try to diversify a little bit.
I really want to see what's going to happen when they get Ben Simmons back. We haven't heard anything about that yet. It's coming up now on almost 2 months since he had that injury. I think it was like September, like 20. 22nd or something. So maybe within a month or so, he could be back. And that would be fantastic. I really want to see where they're going to use him at three. I mean, he'll probably start and they'll probably play Ilyasova, you would think. And then maybe, I guess, Henderson, Covington at the two. I would like to them to play him at the four and play him with Bayless, Henderson.
And Covington for me.
Yeah, and Covington. And then Embiid. You know, that actually, I think, is a starting lineup that could fit together pretty well. Embiid, by the way, 32 points in 28 minutes in the clutch, and he's been quite efficient as well during those minutes. He's been one of the best clutch players in the NBA so far, and the clutch, as you'll recall, games that are within 5 points with under 5 minutes to go is the NBA.com definition, which I think is a pretty good one.
It is. And for those who want to, you can use I believe it's available even on the free site to change those parameters around if you think they're not good.
The Orlando Magic.
Speaking of not good.
Yeah. Now 6-11. They were 6-7 at one point. They really were not deserving of that record. They've been one of the worst teams in basketball in terms of just the way that they have played with their point differential. Are they? They're actually 7th in defense now?
That was before today's game.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so they're actually probably a little bit worse now after that loss to the Bucks. But yeah, 6-11, 3-5 since we last checked in on them. 29th in offense at this point. They actually now, again, we had talked, I think, even on the last program about how Frank Vogel was beginning to grasp at straws, change up the rotation. They'd taken Aaron Gordon out of the starting lineup. He returned there with Jeff Green out with a back injury. The bigger news, Bismack Biyombo actually started instead of Nikola Vucevic. And they just went with three bigs in the rotation at the 4 and 5 spots between Ibaka, Biyombo, and Vucevic. Didn't really play Damian Rudez or any kind of traditional four other than Ibaka. They played Vuce and Biyombo together for quite a bit of time as well. Didn't really look that good. Gordon playing the three. He was 0 for 11. And I think he took all but three of his shots outside the restricted area. And two of those were viciously sent back in his face by Giannis Antetokounmpo. Elfrid Payton also was out of the starting lineup. DJ Augustin was in. And then Vogel, in a tactic that didn't make a ton of sense to me, played Augustin only the first and third quarters, and Payton basically only the second and fourth quarters. And Augustin actually played well in the first quarter too. I don't know why he wasn't allowed to come back in. CJ Watson is now in the rotation. Hazonia, even with Green out, didn't play a single minute. They are just all sorts of messed up right now. And this is what Vogel had to say after the game. We're 30th in offense. I want to explore some new combinations within the same 9 guys being in the rotation, and that does not include Hazonia among those 9, and try to get a different feel, a different flow, Vogel said after the game. So it's really grasping at straws for Orlando right now.
Another thing Vogel said after the game was that he wanted to try to get the ball in Evan Fournier's hands more often. That's a good thing. Evan Fournier can do that, but
well, there's nobody else.
There's nobody else, and their surrounding talent doesn't make sense for that to be the concept of their offense, because they have so little shooting at the one, and then they're playing guys at the three that don't really have that as their forte. And I'm not saying, oh, you should start Hazonia or anything crazy like that, but a stat that really knocked me back, it was actually going to be a part of a podcast we did last week, and then I moved it to this week to the 15 and 60, is the Magic have struggled offensively in all forms, but they've really struggled when Elfrid Payton was on the floor, only in a 98.7 offensive rating. However, when he has been on the bench, and this was before today's game, they've only scored 89.3 points per 100 possessions, which is otherworldly bad. And they spent a bunch of money on Augustin just after spending a bunch of money on CJ Watson. And that's long-term money, and they don't have any real lottery tickets that can help fix that problem either.
No, they don't. And another thing you noted too is they don't have any ISOs, which actually surprised me a little bit, because there's a lot of situations where they're just not really going to get any kind of an impetus offensively, any kind of penetration. You just have to run an ISO at the end, but nobody on this team can do that. And then the whole Aaron Gordon at the three, I mean, I said he was 0 for 11. We've been criticizing that. As the pick and roll ball handler, you know, he's going to be the next Paul George. As of last Monday, 0.32 points per possession on 25 possessions. That is the worst in the league as of that time for anyone with 25 or more possessions.
I was watching at one point, I was bouncing between a few games today, and it was a great illustration of why Gordon at the three is a problem, is that the ball ended up in his hands with about 5 seconds left on the shot clock, and he could actually do something if he was guarding if a traditional four was on him. He can maybe dribble past that guy, draw a foul, get a pull up, but
I think he could do it with a traditional four on him, but I mean, I see your point, it would be easier. I still think he can't even create one-on-one against before, but if he's in not a creation role, he's a energy man, roller, you know, spot up for three type of guy if he's at the four.
Right. And so he gets in that spot, but instead he was driving on Giannis and just got nowhere because Giannis handles that with guys far better than Aaron Gordon. And so it puts him in a position where, yeah, if you want to build his skill set, it could work. But if you want to build his confidence, probably not.
Yeah. And Gordon, the big reason I think, other than trying to get him to grow his skill set offensively, that they want him at the three is because he can be their defensive stopper on the wings. And he looked awful in that role today. He was getting roasted by Giannis. He was getting roasted by Michael Beasley. He just didn't have anything in the way of hustle plays at all. I mean, you feel his presence physically last year when he was playing the four. And I think there's just an overall malaise from this Magic team. The Bucks announcers were talking about how all the Bucks players were up celebrating when good things would happen, and the Magic players were just kind of down. And Vucevic being out of the starting lineup, I don't think that really helps much either. His quote was, "I didn't think there was a reason for me to go to the bench, but it's a coach's decision. I wasn't happy with the decision they made," but then the usual platitudes about giving full effort and helping the team.
Ready to move on to the Knicks?
Yeah, a little sunnier here for them. 5-2 in their last seven, now 8-8.
So they're 15th in offense, 26th in defense, but just you think, oh, league average, below league average, about a 53% chance of making the playoffs. And they've done really well, shock of shocks, without Joakim Noah on the floor.
Yeah, he's played 78 minutes in the last four games, missed some time with an illness. They still have been quite negative, negative 11 net rating in those minutes. And the thing about Noah that shows really how far he's fallen, he has two dunks all year. Like, how does he, and he never shoots outside of the basket area. He's shooting 45%, and his average shot comes from 3.3 feet away from the rim. He had one of the most comical missed jumpers that I've seen at some point in this stretch, where he was just off by like 3 feet to the left. He took it from the right elbow. I feel like he looks like he just had like some kind of a hand injury in addition to that knee surgery in the 2014 offseason, because he just has not been able to catch the ball. He hasn't been able to make a layup, and he hasn't been able to make a jump shot ever since he had that surgery. And that doesn't add up. I mean, some of it's the reduced explosion, but it just doesn't make any sense that like his hands like don't even work anymore now. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's just a confidence issue.
It could be. And it's concerning in some ways also because they've gotten good play out of their other centers who would be more okay with being bit players. Willie Hernangómez has done well. Kyle O'Quinn has done all right. And, you know, you could cobble something together with those kind of guys and Porzingis, you know, been playing Porzingis a little bit at center, playing him at power forward with either one of those guys. But they have this gigantic investment in Noah, and they have to run with it as long as he's healthy.
Derrick Rose actually has played better during this run that they've had over the last seven games. 56% true shooting, actually above average. He's now shooting 59% at the rim, which is still a little below average. But for a point guard, a guy who gets there as often as he does, when you also consider that he creates some offensive rebounds off of those drives, that's actually good. You know, and that's 59% on the season. He was, you know, 48%, 50% these last couple of years. The problem is he still never gets fouled, and he's complained about that earlier in the year. And I don't know why that is. I think he just is kind of plays a little bit softer now, frankly. He doesn't quite have the explosion to get guys wrong-footed. You know, he is shooting as he's blowing by guys, but he's not able to surprise them with his moves and pick up foul calls. There's really only been 1 or 2 years in his career that he was getting to the line at an acceptable rate, and that was the MVP year. That's really what made him the MVP that year. Was it, John Hollinger wrote an article about how, hey, this is why he's not so much of a star. He never gets to the foul line. And then he immediately started getting to the foul line in that MVP season. And then, you know, ever since the injuries, has never been able to get back there. But I think he can still be reasonably efficient if they're playing with a space floor. His jumper still looks terrible, but he's hit a few key jump shots. Still worth noting, though, overall in the season, 80th in RPM among point guards and negative 2.5 RPM, which is horrendous on defense. Another good thing, though, he's playing 32 minutes. We haven't heard anything about an injury from him yet.
And they've needed that because Jennings hasn't been as good as I think, at least for me, as good as I hoped. And they don't.
He's had some good games, but overall, the efficiency hasn't been there.
And something that you noted, which is potentially important in terms of the long-term viability of this team, is that they're last in the league in free throw attempt rate. And that totally makes sense when you think about their personnel and where they are at this point in their careers.
Well, it's been quite a drop off for Melo. He's only averaging, I think, 4.4 free throw attempts per game. So it's basically getting fouled twice a game. And he used to be one of the biggest foul guys. But, you know, it used to be he would go into that triple threat or he'd get post ups right at the rim, get offensive rebounds. He's not really doing that anymore. Now it's just pick and pop. It's let me get your hands down, quick release. I mean, he's still been an effective scorer, but he's not able to get to the foul line. So really for his efficiency now, he's going to be dependent on hitting the three ball regularly. Porzingis as well, another guy who does not get to the foul line at all. He's not powerful enough really to get fouled. He's doing a pick and pop a lot. His moves are more finesse moves, just kind of trying to shoot over guys. And I think that's a good strategy for him because if he tries to go through guys, he's just going to expose the ball, get stripped, get knocked off balance. I think he's better just trying to play in space and use that length to rise over people. At this point in his career, I mean, at some point he's going to have to develop more of a pump fake because with that high release, he'll be able to get guys in the air and do that kind of BS. But yeah, I mean, and then Rose also, those are their three big usage guys. None of them get to the foul line at all.
Anything else you want to talk about with them?
What do you think of their 53% chance of the playoffs per 538 right now?
It's a little rosy because I think they've been playing over their heads a little bit, but on talent, if they can stay moderately healthy, you can make a very good argument that they're the seventh or eighth best team in the East.
Yeah, a lot of it just depends on how much they're going to play Noah, too. It looks like he's playing 17, 18 minutes a game right now. And I think as long as they're winning, that'll probably stay the case unless they just start playing. I mean, it's one of those things where I think they kind of, this is the baseline now. They lucked into the fact that he was injured and they found this new way of playing. The offense has been outstanding. The defense is, during this win streak, where they have a 4.5 net rating. The defense has been below average, but not inadequate. They've been really bad on defense too with Noah. I mean, we've talked about how he really just has struggled defensively. He just does not try to contest shots at the rim anymore, doesn't really have the mobility to switch out the way he used to be able to do in Chicago either, on some of those great teams in the late clock. So with all that, I mean, I think they'll probably still start him and then he'll play those 17 minutes and hope that that doesn't kill them. Because if they start bringing him off the bench, then there might be some issues. But hey, you know, when you get paid $18 million a year for the next 4 years, hopefully you can not complain about sitting on the bench because you're not good enough anymore.
The Milwaukee Bucks are 7-8 after their win today. They've been 2-4 since the last time we did this. They are 18th in offense, 15th in defense, and 538 gives them a 26% chance of making the playoffs.
Same question on that one. How does that sound to you?
It's reasonable. I would say they're one of the kind of lesser teams in that mix for the 8 seed, but they are certainly in the conversation. They can play better than they have. Something that I noticed before today's game, of the 30 most used five-man lineups in the NBA, Dellavedova, Snell, Giannis, Jabari, and John Henson, which has been their most common starting lineup after they brought in Snell, is by far the worst in net rating. They've been out, it's negative 23.4 in 86 minutes. Next lowest, even before today, was the Hawks starting five. That should get better. They're better than that, especially because
Henson was good today. He probably had one of the best games of his career. They were
the best game of the season.
Yeah, they're really finding him in the pick and roll. Deli had some great alley-oops to him, for example.
I'm guessing you like Malcolm Brogdon again today.
Yeah, he, at least in the first half, he's got this ugly jumper that he kind of shoots out in front of his face in a line drive, but he's been focusing on getting his legs into it. He was hitting from three and off the dribble, still can't get to the rim to save his life, but he's got some nice moves off the dribble. He'll move the ball. I mean, that's one of the things that I like about him, is just he moves his body and he moves the ball, and that's something that this team needs away from. They can get stagnant sometimes when the ball is in the hands of Jabari or Giannis. The rotation roulette, I mean, this was like crazy rotation roulette game with Vogel and Kidd together. Vogel actually had one of the more stable rotations when he was in Indiana. I think he's just searching right now. Kidd has always been kind of crazy, and now it's Henson starting. That worked. The token third center who plays for 2 minutes at the end of the first half was Plumlee, who and then Monroe played like 16 minutes and he was pretty effective as well. I think some of their other problems though is that they have not really been effective without Giannis on the floor.
No, they have not. And with Giannis, they've been, this is before today, they're at 105.2 per 100, which is solid. That's around top 10 offense if you were to prorate it for a whole game. And without him, 94.1 real bad. And that makes sense when you think about their personnel, because Dellavedova is their best secondary ball handler, but they're playing him with Giannis because that's the best role for him in terms of the scope of the team. And Jason Terry's more of an off-ball guy. Brogdon can't really carry that load yet. And that's why I've been of the belief that Greg Monroe would be a nice fit with that unit, but there are reasons, I guess, why they haven't been doing so.
Yeah, well, part of it, I think, is just that with Monroe and Jabari, how are you going to stop anybody? Maybe that's kind of what the thought is there. And then they'll throw in like Teletovic or Beasley, like some of their bench guys. I still think Teletovic should play more. Like Beasley is actually, I've been impressed with how effective he's been. I haven't looked at the stats, but it looks like he is getting to the basket way more than he has in some of his previous stops. It's not just mid-rangers. He's actually like, especially he's being guarded by power forwards, he actually has been able to kind of blow by, finish with both hands around the rim. He's had some really nifty reverse layups. I mean, he definitely is an NBA player, and I think that the Bucks won that Ennis trade for Beasley. I don't know that Beasley necessarily could have helped the Rockets that much this year. He's not really a Mike D'Antoni type of player. But I think he's been good. But I also would like to see more minutes for Teletovic as well, just because he spaces the floor so much. I've been impressed by how Teletovic actually has just become more of a shameless gunner. He needed that, I think, when he was in New Jersey. And now he'll shoot quickly without his feet set. Like, he's looking like Kyle Korver out there sometimes with some of the positions that he's shooting from. So I think I'd like to see more from him. I'd like to see them do more switching when he's in the lineup as well. Last thing, too, they have not been that terrible from three-point range, in part due to Teletovic. Jabari shooting better than anticipated. And then Tony Snell not shooting a great percentage. He never really has in his career. He's at 32% on his 5.3 catch and shoot threes per game, but that's eighth in the league. They needed someone who at least you had to guard out there, and Snell falls into that category. I think that trade is looking like it worked. I mean, he's playing over 30 minutes per game for them and not killing them. And considering where they were at the start of the season, having to make a trade for a guy who is sitting on someone's bench, you know, there are a bunch of teams that could have used Snell, and maybe they didn't have a Michael Carter Williams to trade for him, but he was not going to be in the rotation in theory in Chicago this year. And I think he's done what they could have hoped for him to do. He's been effective defensively too.
Something else I wanted to mention is that the Bucks players are getting better at finding Teletovic, because he's unusual in the sense that he is a good three-point shooter who shoots a vast majority above the break. And in certain offenses, that can be a problem just because of where he's available. But there were a couple plays today, particularly in the fourth quarter, where the Magic were just losing him. And Giannis in particular would go, oh crap, that's Teletovic, and just throw him the ball and Teletovic is going to shoot it because that's what he does. And just drilling those shots, and it creates a seam that defenses are still far too willing to let up. And he's one of the best shooters above the break threes in the entire league, was something I tracked a lot last year, because as Curry was doing his ridiculousness above the break, it was almost always Teletovic and JJ Redick that were in the mix there in terms of effectiveness. And he can do that. He's very comfortable with it. You talked about the idea of higher frequency. So the more they play together, the more that focusing on Giannis, focusing on Jabari could lead to some really, really nice Teletovic nights.
Speaking of Jabari, I had highlighted on previous programs some of the moves that he made. I got a chance to just talk to him one-on-one at Bucks Shooteron when I was up there about a week ago about some of the moves, what he's doing to work on his game, trying to get to the foul line a little bit more. So we'll just play that. It's about 3-4 minutes here. Hopefully you're interested. I thought it was an interesting conversation.
So this is actually a couple of weeks ago I want to ask you about. I'm from the Bay Area, but I'm not here. You had this move against Milwaukee. I think you were on a switch against Ish Smith, you post it up, and you basically, like, fake spun one way, kind of, like, left the ball there and went back the other way and went in for left. You remember that move at all? Yeah. I've never seen anyone do that. Did you, like, invent that? Did someone teach you that? Where'd you get that from?
I guess it's just, like, a movement trying to throw guys off. You know, I grew up playing on the playground, so, you know, every little, you know, shake, you know, every little move to throw off your defender is actually a step ahead of your opponent.
Yeah. So is that like you just kind of improvise that at the time? That's not like something you practice necessarily?
No, it's not something I practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely something that just comes with the flow of the game.
Yeah. So I want to ask you too a little bit about like your recovery from the ACL. It seemed to me like last year, it was like, you know, I've watched you from like high school and college. You shot like really, you know, you got a lot of elevation on your jumper. And then when you came back last year, you weren't shooting that well from outside. You were kind of like between like a set shot and a jumper. Is that true, or am I, you feel free to correct me on that, but it kind of seemed like that was that was the case. Is that true, or you?
There's some truth in that. I think part of my recovery, finding my way back to the game, that I know I can play. Just starting inside, and what I really trying to focus on is, you know, attacking it from the inside. You know, working on my drives, working on my ball handling, my cuts, and then you know, with time, you know, my jump shot will go, will grow, and I actually like the way that they're playing me now. So, you know, as soon as I get those open shots and they can test me the next plays, you know, I can go to my strength. So that's a good, it's a good position for me.
Yeah, you probably don't realize this, actually. I couldn't sleep last night. I was on NBA.com. You know, they have these, like, listings of, like, what, like, play types everyone is finishing. They, like, pick and roll and, like, isolation. You have the most possessions in the league of anyone on spot-ups, which is either, like, jumpers or, like, driving off of, like, a close-on. Does that surprise you at all?
No, that's pretty much a scout report because, you know, guys, you know, they sag off a lot. But I just got to keep shooting it if I want to grow, if I want to get better.
Yeah. Another thing, too, you drive to the rim a lot, take a lot of shots inside. Haven't been getting a lot of calls this year so far. And is that something you discuss with the rest? Is there anything you think you could do to improve that? Is it just, you know, getting more respect and technique? Like, I mean, is that something that you've been thinking about at all?
Yeah, definitely try to get calls my way. You know, I can't control the refs, but I just got to keep on driving in there and, you know, just trying to finish to score instead of looking for a call.
Yeah, I mean, you think, like, just because you're so strong, like, guys kind of bounce off you and it's, like, harder to get those calls sometimes?
Yeah, it could be, but like you said, I don't get as much calls. You know, I don't get as many foul calls. There's other guys who play a more finesse game. Yeah. You know, they get way more calls than myself. So I think with time, man, it just improved.
All right, before we move on to the Miami Heat, a word from SeatGeek. You may have heard the kitten meowing in the background, and she also likes SeatGeek. Unfortunately, SeatGeek does not sell tickets to see my kitten being incredibly cute right now walking on this ledge, but they do sell tickets to virtually anything else that requires tickets. Music, theater, of course, sports with the NBA season being back. SeatGeek, the smartest, easiest way to find tickets for the games you want to see up close and in person this season. SeatGeek has the best deals on every ticket in the house, whether it's courtside, club seats, upper level. They make your life easier by doing all the price comparison for you. They search multiple ticket sites and they ensure you get the best deal. You don't have to worry that you already went to 8 sites. You don't want to look at a 9th one, but you kind of feel like you should to make sure you're not missing out on some deals. SeatGeek will take care of that for you now. Moreover, SeatGeek gives every ticket a grade based on value. So you'll see any underpriced seats. You'll be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. And my listeners, of course, get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. You download that free SeatGeek app, go into the settings tab, click add a promo code, enter that promo code CAPSPACE, very familiar, talk about it all the time on the program, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So download that free SeatGeek app, enter promo code CAPSPACE today. Miami 5-11, 3-5, 27th in offense, 5th in defense, 21% chance of making the playoffs. They are projected at 34 wins, I believe. Is that right?
32-50 is what I have.
Okay. So that would be 4 games out of the projected awful playoff line of 36 so far. I mean, but what do you think subjectively? You think these guys are done?
I don't know what them being not done would signify, because even if they made the playoffs, the parallel I've been drawing over the last couple days is to that Milwaukee Bucks team that made the playoffs a couple years ago. You know, they got in, but that was encouraging because they were really young. This Heat team has some young guys. They also have Whiteside, who's older than some people think because he was in the wilderness for so long. Dragic is in his late 20s. And so if they made the playoffs, be great for Spo, you know, maybe get some consideration for coach of the year. It'd be a nice
help free agency, I think. I think that's the
biggest
thing.
Yeah, I guess it would in that sense, but they also are owing all these picks coming up and it would be just that quick first round exit. So if that makes the difference in free agency, then maybe you go for it in it, because they do have different incentives than most teams for that exact reason, because we've seen in the last few years what looking hopeless does for free agency. It does not bode well, but they just don't have a lot in terms of, like, you know, in terms of ways to get better outside of this weird cap situation that they might have this summer if they can clear Chris Bosh.
Yeah, well, because it basically is going to go away because Tyler Johnson's contract goes up by so much in 2018. This is kind of their one chance. Now, you could also make the argument that they're better off just getting a high pick, but I don't think they're going to be bad enough. I mean, unless they just stop trying defensively. I mentioned their 5th in defense. And they would actually probably be better off if they just hadn't had these injuries. Like, they've had two injuries now to Dragic, a sprained ankle, and this elbow injury. Justice Winslow has been out now for some time. Whiteside, actually, I think, has been playing extremely well. I mean, probably better than they could have hoped. I mean, for him to be the centerpiece of the fifth-ranked defense, the criticism of him was that he really was just hunting his own stats. And they've defended effectively with him out there. And they've had Willie Reed out, too. They don't really have any kind of a backup big man who's been able to play right now. Reed has a hyperextension in his knee. If they could ever get healthy, I feel like this is close to a 500 team. They've had a lot of close losses against pretty good teams. I mean, they were on the road against the Spurs. I don't think the Spurs arrested that many people in that game. They've had a lot of games where they've played hard. And it's going to be a race to see whether they can get healthy before it just looks so hopeless that they can't get back into it, and then, you know, the tank starts loading up.
There's a lot to like. Spo does a good job coaching. They have versatile athletes who try, and that makes a big difference in the regular season. Those are things that do not necessarily bode well in the playoffs. You can't really win on that, but in the regular season, you absolutely can, especially if the other team's on a back-to-back or something like that. And, you know, I think for the most part, maybe fifth in defense is a little rosy, but a lot of that seems real to me.
A couple of more notes on this team. Defensively, they have been outstanding protecting the basket. When they contest a shot, defense or offenses are shooting 44.9% within 5 feet. In the restricted area, which is a little bit smaller than that 5 feet, they give up only 51.4%. That is 4% better than anybody else's this year. And then the best last year was 56.7%, and the league average is around 60 in that category. And so that's, they're not gonna be able to keep that up all year, because it seems like basically nobody does that. But I thought it would be interesting to take a look just in general. This is kind of more of a research thing to look at, and forgive me if this is something that's been looked at before, but to look at what areas on the court defenses most control shooting. And it seems clear that in the restricted area, that's about where you have the most effect. The spread between the best and the worst restricted area shooting defensively is usually about 10%, between 55% and 65%, roughly. If you're looking at the paint outside of the restricted area, that lowers to only about a 6% spread between the best and worst defenses. And then when you look at mid-rangers and threes, we talk about all the time on here that opponent three-point shooting percentage, not something that defenses can really control. That's more just about keeping the number of attempts down. So mid-rangers and threes, jumpers, basically only a 4-5% spread between the best and the worst. So the greater the difference between the best and the worst, you would posit that the defense has more control over that. And I think, you know, having a good shot blocker versus a mediocre shot blocker makes much more difference on shots around the rim than jump shots do. And then if you look at it offensively, the spread is about 10% basically in all of the areas. Mid-rangers are a little bit smaller. That's 8%, 12% on paint, non-restricted area. So that shows really that the offense is controlling most of it. Once you get outside of the restricted area, it's more about the offense's ability to make shots necessarily. And contesting obviously is important, but it's more about just not giving up those shots to begin with. And I think another part of it too is that teams shoot around the basket all the time, even when the defense is there and trying to stop you. Usually you're not going to be taking a shot outside of the immediate basket area unless you're some modicum of open. And that's why I think the defense doesn't affect that as much either.
Makes a lot of sense. And it'd be interesting to, if you, there was a way to do it in terms of also frequency, because as we know, the best teams also deter high value shots and encourage low value shots.
Let's get to Indiana. Somehow 9-9, two dominating victories out of nowhere, one against a Brooklyn team that really is falling down the stairs at this point, but then destroyed the Clippers, held them to only 70 points. This defense now up to 17th. They had really through their first 10 games, they're in the bottom three or four in the league, as I recall. Still only 22nd in offense. I don't know how much that's going to improve, but I mean, to have had these wins without Paul George is fantastic. And yeah, they have not been that good overall in terms of their point differential, but they're 500 and they've played now a bunch of games without Paul George.
It's weird to feel the same way as I did at the beginning of the season, but be more optimistic just because they banked a few wins. Like that really is what has happened.
Well, didn't we have them as like slightly over 500 at the start of the year?
I think so. Something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of today's game you watched, but I was one of the ones that I was flipping between. And it was just amazing throughout the game that the Clippers are generally one of the most judicious teams with the ball. That was a huge disparity in this game, was a 7 turnover advantage for the Pacers. And then offensive rebounding, the Clippers actually have engaged less in to focus on stopping teams in transition. The Pacers had a +7 there. And those two things combined with just fouling the Clippers more often led to a 22 field goal attempt advantage in this game, which was a large part of the margin, because when you just put up that many more shots, you're going to do it. And the Clippers missed more than they usually do.
The Paul George injury raised some eyebrows to you at all, the way it's been handled? It does for me, because he missed, I think, 2 or 3 games with this sprained ankle. Then he plays 38 minutes, and then he has recurring soreness, and he sits again now for, I think, 3 or 4 games. This is the first time that he's missed it any time, essentially, since he had that horrific broken leg. It's not the best. Anytime someone comes back, tries to play, and then has to sit out again with the same injury, and there weren't any reports that he, like, retweaked it or anything, it's been soreness, you wonder a little bit.
You do, and they have a big trip coming up, a series of important opponents. They face the Blazers, the Clippers, and the Warriors, and then less critical against the Suns and the Mavericks. But if they're going to be competitive in fighting for a playoff spot in the East, in some ways those road games against lesser teams could be more important, just because they have a greater chance
Suns
of winning.
Suns, Mavericks, like, those are the type of games you got to win if you're going to be in the playoffs if you're Indiana.
And then they only have 2 more home games, and then they go on the road again. So if they can get right maybe in some of those winnable ones, that's going to be what separates it. Because it's unlikely Paul George could come back, because he's already basically out until through Wednesday's game, and then he could be back December 4th against the Clippers, and they play the Warriors the next night. Those two games probably tough for them to take either one, despite beating the Clippers today. But they're going to need more really from everybody. Fortunately, Jeff Teague turned it around after he got in that time to panic episode for a good reason. He's done a lot better.
Yeah, he has, but I looked at his last 8 games. He's still only averaging 15 points, and not on incredible efficiency either. He's had a couple of, like, big, nice games, like that overtime game that they somehow won against Oklahoma City. I mean, yeah, those have been, like, 3 really nice wins that they've had without Paul George. He hasn't been terrible the way he was. He's still shooting poorly on 3-pointers. They're going to need more shooting from him, but at least he looks a little bit better. He tweaked his ankle against the Warriors, but he's been back since then. I think said that he could return even in that game, but it was such a blowout that he didn't, and he's been back since. Thad Young, a bright spot for the Pacers. He's shooting 43% on threes, and it looks very legitimate. We talked about how he, at the start of the year, he's only really about a 30% career 3-point shooter, not a ton of volume. And not only is he shooting a good percentage, I'm just liking the way he's shooting an easy ball. I mean, he'll be taking shots where he kind of backs up, has to get his feet straight. You know, it's not just like a dead spot up, got an hour to get it off type of shots that he's been hitting. And I really like how aggressive he's been from three. I hope that continues. I think with his shooting and Turner's shooting, and then you throw George in there, that could allow Teague and Ellis, who are not great shooters, to get to the basket. Now, of course, you still want the ball in Paul George's hands, and then that lack of shooting from Teague and Ellis becomes more of a problem. So you have that fit issue, but at least if Young is going to be shooting threes, which he hasn't throughout most of his career, and you have to guard him out there, I think that can be big for their offense. Turner, his shooting, he's at 60% on long twos, and those are 30% of his shots. So that's not going to continue. He's shooting 54%, but a lot of it is on the strength of those. He's shooting only 25% on threes. Maybe that'll go up a little bit. And then Monte Ellis, the RPM rankings came out recently. Small sample, but 82nd in real plus minus among shooting guards. So far, so ready to move on to Detroit?
I want to say one thing about Thad Young. His 3-point attempt rate is one of the more varied in the league, at least in terms of players I can think of, because early in Philly, he actually attempted a couple of games, and then that completely evaporated until
Doug
his
Collins
last,
ruined him.
Yeah, until
Doug
his
Collins
last year with the last year with the Sixers, which I believe was post-Collins. Then he attempted 3.7 a game, which is still his career high. Then he dipped again playing for the Nets, and then now he's back up. And I've wondered at moments in the season what would have happened him if he had been able to play with Kenny Atkinson in Brooklyn this year.
Yeah, that might have been interesting to see. And they're still, I think they're not quite using him as a 3-point shooter enough in this Indiana offense. All right, let's talk about Detroit now. 8-10, 3-5. They had a West Coast trip that didn't go so well. 24th in offense, 6th in defense, still despite the 8-10 record, given a 68% chance at the playoffs. But I gotta be honest, I haven't watched that much of these guys lately. I kind of hate watching them. They are, especially with Reggie Jackson out, I feel like I'm not learning that much. And they're kind of playing some ugly basketball too.
It's just a slog a lot of times. And there have been some nice performances. KCP had one very good game that was exciting. But they're just kind of playing these sometimes nasty games and winning a fair amount of them. Credit to Stan Van Gundy for having a team that can actually pull that off. But it's also weird, because I'm not saying this is a way to make a team watchable, but they're having a super low free throw attempt rate when you have Andre Drummond on your team is just shocking.
Yeah, they just don't have anyone who is getting to the rim. And I think so much is going to change, at least I hope, when Jackson returns. And they're talking about him being back within the next couple of weeks now. He's moved to resuming basketball activities after he had that procedure on that severe tendonitis in his knee. But yeah, they are 30th in three-point attempt rate, 25th in pace, not particularly exciting there. And that 30th in three-point attempt rate is disappointing because they also don't get any offensive rebounds. Like Drummond is the only guy who gets the offensive glass. He is not getting there nearly as often because they don't have that threat in the pick and roll with Jackson the way they have previously. And then Tobias Harris, KCP, Marcus Morris, all those guys are really bad rebounders, especially on defense. None of those guys has over a 7.5% total rebound percentage. And when you have Morris and Harris nominally combo forwards, they should be better. And so that's how, even though you have the best rebounder in the NBA, you're 21st in offensive rebounds and 18th in defensive rebounds here. It would be nice to see them do a little bit more. Lure does a decent job on the glass, but outside of that, nobody other than their centers gets rebounds on this team.
A piece of unfortunate news, even though he has been marginalized just throughout his NBA career, Reggie Bullock tore his meniscus. There isn't a timetable yet that I've seen. And he did get some minutes actually against Boston and Houston before that injury, but he'll be out for a while. And by that point, he'll probably be supplanted in the rotation if he had even made his way in with just two games.
Yeah, and he started off injured this year as well. He's had a lot of nagging injuries that never really have gotten much publicity because he hasn't been in the rotation. But I think that's part of why we've talked about how he was on the Clippers and the Suns and even Detroit teams that really needed his services, or at least what he theoretically could do, was drafted to do as a 3-and-D guy. And so the fact that he has struggled to stay healthy, even though he hasn't been playing, has really flummoxed any efforts that he might have had. The other thing I'm going to be watching for this team once Reggie gets back, Beto Udrich actually has been pretty good. He's saved them. When you look at there, would have had Ray McCallum or I think Lorenzo Brown were competing to be that third point guard, which then would have been the backup. Beno is the best net rating on the team, which is a marked turnaround from the good old Blake and Baines losing factory, as you so glibly christened them last year. Ish Smith continues to be incredibly inefficient, and it'd be interesting to see who should and will be the backup point guard when Reggie Jackson comes back. That's gonna be important because Reggie plays a lot less minutes than you would think as well. And you'd think coming off this knee injury, he's still going to be around the 30-minute per game mark.
We know who, or at least we have a pretty good idea who will, but who should is probably a more compelling question.
Cleveland, 13-2, 6-1, a nasty second in offense. And they are over 111 points per 100, which is well beyond what the league leader usually has in a normal year. The Warriors, of course, are at 115. Completely ridiculous. That would be the best offensive rating now by over 2 points per 100. 14th in defense. They have a 63% chance of the top seed. I mean, I guess it's probably higher than that, you would think, just because of what we know about this team. 14% chance of winning the title. That actually seems low to me as well.
Agreed.
Based on how good they have been so far this year. And the biggest thing, I mean, is the three-point shooting has been unbelievable. Channing Frye in particular.
Channing Frye is attempting 5.6 catch and shoot threes per game and making more than 46% of them, which is phenomenal.
Yeah, that's been fantastic. Zach Lowe noted that he's taking almost 12 three-pointers per 36 minutes, which is, I mean, for perspective, Steph Curry was taking 11 a game last year and averaging about 34 minutes. So that's actually like more than Steph Curry was taking. And that was one of the most ridiculous per minute three-point attempt rates. It might've been the highest ever, I'm guessing, over a certain minute threshold last year. And then Kevin Love, he, I don't know if I quite want to say he's back to Minnesota level Kevin Love's, but he's averaging a very efficient 24 game and that 34 point quarter. Were you watching that live?
I was actually, because that was the day before Thanksgiving and I was terrified about driving to Oracle because the Warriors played that night. So I stayed home and went late, and I was watching that almost the whole time. I started in like 2 or 3 minutes in, and he was phenomenal. I mean, making every shot. And there were a few times where Kyrie either, I'll use the phrase missed, because I don't know if it was deliberate or accidental. And he absolutely could have passed Klay Thompson's record in that, because there were three times in the last minute that he was open and Kyrie just didn't give him the ball.
Yeah, I went back and watched the film of that because I was interested to see how was it that he could get so open. And it started off, he was playing against a terrible Portland defense, much like Klay Thompson was playing against a terrible Sacramento defense in his 37-point quarter. Portland started Plumlee and Davis in that game, two bigs, and he was being guarded most of the time by Plumlee, which neither of those guys has the mobility to guard him at the arc. And he got it started actually with probably the toughest shot, a fadeaway on the baseline off of one leg over Plumlee, and then he really just got it going. It was a dribble handoff with Kyrie. Portland, not a team that switches. He just did that dribble handoff, popped to the corner, got a wide open three. Plumlee wasn't able to get out on him. Then another thing that really worked well against the ice coverage that Portland was doing, this is great to have a shooting big like Fry or Love, because if you try to ice the pick and roll, all the ball handler has to do is just dribble towards the basket. Both his man and the big are going to sink down with him, and then you just throw it back to the top of the key and the guy has a wide open three. So that's how he hit his next three with Plumlee on him. The next time Plumlee came over to the strong side to try and stop a Kyrie ISO, just threw it to Love for another wide open three. Then LeBron found him in the right corner in transition after a drive in from the left side. It was really, and all these were open shots. Like, there wasn't really a point where you're like, oh my God, he's hitting these ridiculous shots. It's just, he just kept getting wide open like Portland. And, you know, of course, people were tweeting at me, oh, hey, you're such a moron because you thought that it was a good idea to leave Kevin Love open. That's the way you stop the Cavs. Well, I don't think that's the way you stop the Cavs when they're going with a traditional big. I would much rather just switch and, you know, try to have some size and deal with Love that way, deal with him posting you up instead. But when they go with him at center, I still think that's what the least worst of the options. But nonetheless, like all of these plays, and you know, he got to the foul line a few times as well later on. You don't need to go through the entire play-by-play. And then he even was able to post up when Portland did start switching everything, but they've got these little guards like Lillard who aren't gonna be able to handle him in the post. It was just so easy for him to get open, and he really, if he hits those shots at like the rate that he did in this game, the way that he has been so far this season, if he really, again, is a 40% three-point shooter, I don't know how you stop these guys unless you just have five like-sized guys who can switch. The Warriors can come close to that. You can still attack Steph as they have, but the Warriors are really the only team in the last 2 years that has had any success slowing down this Cleveland offense.
LeBron's passing was a big part of Love's success in this, because there were a couple where he hit Love on a pass that just most guys don't even see, much less throw. And that certainly gives them an added dimension, especially when Kyrie is on, because then they have not only two guys who are talented scorers, LeBron shooting, I still question, but they have the right surrounding talent to make this offense sing. I'm still skeptical of their defense when it comes down to it, because Cleveland, as great as they are in transition, you know, you negate that largely if they have to get the ball out of the basket, and they just don't have the personnel to handle the best of the best, but their offense is good enough to make them competitive. You know, I think they're by far the favorites in the East and would have at worst a puncher's chance in the finals against anyone.
Yeah, I think that's right, just because these amazing offensive talents can just blow up enough. And you know, obviously they had games where the Warriors could not stop them last year, but you know, and even in game seven the Cavs didn't score incredibly well in those games that the Warriors won, it was the same way. But yeah, I mean, these guys, Kyrie, LeBron, like they can be completely unstoppable for anybody, especially when you consider the level of shooting that can be put around them. All right, let's move on here. And sorry if we're giving a little bit shorter shrift to these teams at the end here, but we're kind of running out of time. That's why we always alternate the order, so that because we have a tendency to drone on early in the show. So skip to the Chicago, 10-6, 4-2, only their third winning circus trip. This is actually the last circus trip, because they're not, the circus contract has not been renewed anymore at the United Center, but they take a November road trip every year, and only the third winning one since the dynasty years, going 4-2 on that trip.
They're 7th in offense, 9th in defense, and a question I had for you was, which of those do you feel is more likely to sustain?
Oh, that is an interesting question. So if you look at how they're doing it offensively, number 1 in offensive rebound percentage, number 6 in avoiding turnovers, number 8 in getting to the foul line, 23rd in e-field goal percentage. Now, I think you could say, at least, I don't think that offensive rebounding is the type of thing where you get hot, although they have been dropping there. They were at 32%, now they're at 30. So there are, anything that's an outlier like that, you expect that there's going to be a natural regression. I think they're still going to get to the foul line. A lot of it, to me, just depends on what happens with Rondo. If they're going to minimize his role, I think they can even come close to sustaining this level. They might even be close to the second best team in the East. And then defensively, they're not forcing any turnovers. They're actually bad on the defensive glass, which is a surprise. They don't foul ever, which is impressive. They're number 1 in avoiding giving up free throws. And then they're 11th in e-field goal percentage. I guess I would say it's the defense is more likely to sustain. But a lot of it depends. I would expect them to take mild steps back in both. But I think if they end up minimizing Rondo's role a little bit, that they might actually get to be pretty good. I mean, especially if Carter Williams can come back, I think he can be acceptable defensively, allow him to switch a little bit more too. I think he could actually be better than Rondo, depending on how he plays. He doesn't have the vision of Rondo, obviously. He won't get on transition as much. So I don't know. I that's a tough question. I don't have a great answer. I think they'll take mild steps back in both.
I think it's more likely they'll sustain the offense, but it is a close question. And the reason for that is just that I see some real trouble spots defensively that you can't really paper over just with the way, if they're going to play Taj.
If they just didn't play Rondo and played Felicio instead of Bobby Portis, which apparently is not, that Felicio
their second unit defense would get a lot better. But I just think when you have Ron, the point guards they have and are actually going to play, when you combine that with Wade getting kind of more into a malaise, especially as we get later in the season, I don't think he'll stay as engaged on that. And their shooting has been hot, but they have talent on that end. So my read on it is that they'll both decrease just like you do, but that the defense is on shakier ground, at least by a little bit.
Yeah, their whole point guard situation is on shaky grounds. Jerry Grant had that one unbelievable game in Portland, but he's shooting 31% from the field, 42% true shooting. He's not yet at an NBA level. He did have a nice game in the D League with 34 points yesterday. But aside from that, I'm not willing to say that he's ready to contribute yet. Rondo, we know what he is. I mean, if you ever watch him on a switch, like how little he competes and actually tries to like muscle up, it's pretty pathetic.
Or on a screen.
Yeah.
Not even switching.
Yeah. Cannon, he's shooting 31% on threes. He's actually been better defensively than I thought he would be. He's at least got some strength, but he's short, doesn't have the length. He's at least, you're going to respect him on three-pointers. Or do you go with just McDermott, who's been out basically like most of the year now with the second concussion? Could he, Butler and Wade play together? Will Rondo accept that? Where does Carter Williams fit in? All those are big questions to me. This is what I wanted to say, though. Let's say they continue on this pace. They get to the second round, they lose to Cleveland, or they lose to Boston. I think that's about the best you could hope for from this team. Maybe by some miracle, they get to the East Finals. I put them as below Toronto and Boston, and maybe even Atlanta in those rankings. We'll see. Atlanta's taking a step back now. They move on from Rondo. If they do that, he's only got $3 million guaranteed. They would have about $20 million in room with the cap holds of either Mirotić or Gibson. If they keep both of them, they're probably down to about $10 million in room. What do you do at that point?
You pray that one of the point guards that, probably Chris Paul and Steph are out of the market for them, but you hope that somebody more in the Drew, Jeff Teague lane is willing to join you.
Yeah, George Hill might be another one, because I think they're really, that's where they have to upgrade.
If George Hill was willing to go there, he would be a nice fit because of the on-ball, off-ball stuff we've gushed about with the Jazz.
Yeah, and maybe I think the way he's kind of been actualized, having the ball in his hand some more with the Jazz, he probably would not be as eager to go to the Bulls, but hey, maybe if they offer him the most money, I think they're still going to miss Taj Gibson. I don't necessarily want to pay Taj Gibson's next contract at age 32, but he has been awesome.
That's okay. So Thibodeau will do it.
Well, he'd be better than anyone they've had there so far this year too. After that Wolves Warriors game, we'll have a lot of comments on the next 15 and 60 about the Wolves. I want to talk a little bit about what Jimmy Butler has been doing too. He basically has been better in just about every way. 86th percentile in pick and roll ball handler, points per possession over one, which is excellent. It's concerning considering the league average is like 0.8 in that. ISOs, he's been excellent. Also, 0.98 points per possession. Again, that's excellent. Getting out in transition, he's good. Spotting up, which includes drives off of spot ups, he's been good. Posting up, he's been solid. All these, basically, he's like 80th, 90th percentile in all these categories. And it's very, very impressive. Even coming off of screens, he's been excellent. He's been getting on the offensive glass too. When he does that, he gets a put back. So really good. Do you think he is the second best player in the Eastern Conference so far this season?
He has been so far. Absolutely. And
yeah. I don't know that he is, but yes, I think he has been.
The improvement for him offensively is kind of like a poor man's version of what Kawhi did, where he just got better at everything at once. And it doesn't necessarily make the whole thing sustainable, but it makes different pieces encouraging for their own reasons. And we've seen Kawhi build on that this year.
Yeah, it's been impressive. If he were a couple of years younger, then the sky would really be the limit. But he does look to have his athleticism back now too, after that knee injury, which is great for him. I still think that Paul George is a little bit better of a player than he is, but you know, he's making it a conversation for sure. All right, let's get on to Charlotte. 9-7, 3-5 in their last eight games. They have been hurt by injuries. They've had Cody Zeller miss time. Marvin Williams now is out with an injury as well. Zeller is back. They split a home and home with the Knicks going into overtime and losing at Madison Square Garden. Where are they in terms of the league rankings?
11th in offense, 9th in defense, 84% chance of making the playoffs, and I was amused, a 1% chance of winning the title.
Yeah, I think they have been better than their record, especially when you consider the injuries. They are insanely dependent on Kemba Walker, though, and I don't know how sustainable his performance is. He's shooting 41% on threes. He's also third in the league, taking 4.8 pull-up threes per game at 35%. Now, that's good enough that you can't go under on him anymore, and that, again, has really opened things up for him as well. But yeah, if his jumper stops falling, I think they could really struggle to score. He also has been outstanding in the clutch. I looked at this in the middle of the week last week, so it's a little out of date. But in 9 clutch games, 39% usage, 70% true shooting in the clutch. They had gone 5-4 in such games. Now they're 6-5 after these last two Knicks games. But he has been unbelievable. But the depth pieces, other than Zeller and Batum, you'd be hard pressed to point to anyone else really who's playing well on this team other than those three guys.
And last year they had, you know, Courtney Lee played well for them, and he wasn't there the whole season, of course.
Offensively, I should say. I think there are guys playing well defensively, sure, but offensively, yeah.
Jeremy Lin last year was a huge bright spot. He's gone, you know, sitting on the bench in Brooklyn because of his hamstring injury. And their center depth is a major concern. You know, that was something that we've talked about, how Steve Clifford has been able to, you know, make lemonade out of everything, but he hasn't been able to make lemonade out of Roy Hibbert yet.
Yeah, Roy, I think he may be about done. He is still protecting the rim reasonably well, but offensively just does not have it. And he has the second worst defensive rating on the team because he can't move. He is getting on the offensive glass a little bit, which is the only way that they're actually getting any offensive rebounds. When he's not in there, they've got Hawes and Kaminsky, guys who just want to space out. So with that, they're only getting 15% of offensive rebounds. I mean, that would be, the Hawks, I think, were like 20% last year, and that was the lowest in NBA history. I mean, when you get down to that level, like 15%, there's a baseline level of offensive rebounds that you kind of have to get. It's really hard to be a good offense if you're not at least getting a few. Marvin Williams is shooting pretty poor. Poorly. As I said, he is at 34% from the field, 34% on threes. And then Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, remember how like this might be the year that his jumper was going to come around? Not so.
I'm not sure that year is ever going to happen, even though I still like him a lot as a player.
Yeah, he is at age 22, but he's at 32%, 8 out of 25 on twos outside the paint. He has taken a mere 2 3-pointers, both from the corners, missed them both, and then 2 out of 15 in the paint outside of the restricted area, and then shooting about average 59% in the restricted area. And a lot of these games, he actually has not even been closing, I think just due to his offense. They need his defense. I mean, like against the Knicks, he even like wasn't playing down the stretch. It was Batum who was guarding Carmelo Anthony. If MKG isn't out there to guard Carmelo, what's the point? But I guess if he just still can't shoot at all, it's going to continue to be an issue, and he is going to have to not close with some games. I still was hoping we would see more of him at the four. Maybe with Marvin Williams out, that'll happen. But I think Clifford
They haven't gotten enough from their wings. I mean, when you're playing MKG at the four.
Yeah, who else are you going to play? I mean, I guess it would be, well, Bellinelli has had a couple of nice games lately. So maybe you play MKG at the four, Batum at the three, Bellinelli at the two.
Yeah, it's not going to be Jeremy Lamb. And Batum, I believe, was
Lamb,
dealing.
Lamb actually had like a really nice game the other day.
He did.
I think, did he have like 18 points and 17 rebounds? Did I read that right?
I think the 18 points is right. I'm legitimately unsure about the 17 rebounds. Yeah, he started due to, I can't remember who was hurt that game, but Batum was dealing with a corneal abrasion, I believe. And so they just have a lot of different things at once. And the Hornets are at the point where I think they're going to
He had 18 and 17 in that home win against the Knicks.
Where they'll be, I trust them as a regular season team. Absolutely do. Still dubious about them in the playoffs just because they don't have a go-to lineup that without a flaw or anything like that. But if they can be, you know, let's say the somewhere between the third and the fifth best team in the East, that has to be considered a success.
Yeah, it's just if they have these injuries, it could be a problem.
Or if Kemba comes back to Earth, because
they do not have the depth.
They're one thing you caught, which is incredibly important with this team, especially when you consider what Kemba can do himself. They have the second highest assist percentage in the entire league, so 65% of their made field goals are assisted.
Yeah, and Kemba really the only guy who's going to create much one-on-one. Maybe Batum a little bit, but he has not quite been as good as last year. All right, the cratering Brooklyn Nets, 0-7 since we last looked at them. They were an inspiring 4-5 when we did the first 15-60, and they had somehow won a couple of games at home, and they've been on the road a little bit too, but also just had some really desultory performances. Got destroyed by the Kings today. 23rd in offense, 27th in defense. What did you take from watching that Nets Kings game? I didn't catch that one today.
They don't have enough shot creation. It can be that simple at points. Vasquez, they already cut. Jeremy Lin is still out. They're 2-9 in the games that he missed, and it all feeds together because they don't have an identity really on either end of the floor because they don't have that kind of dominant personnel. Today, they also, even though Rondé has not had the greatest season, he has an ankle issue. He didn't play at all, so they started Isaiah Whitehead along with Kilpatrick, Bohan, Booker, and Brook Lopez, and that lineup just can't do much against a competent team. And the Kings are
the Kings.
They're inconsistently competent, but they certainly do have their moments.
Yeah, they are. That's true. Like, the Kings will surprise you by actually like playing really well in certain games.
You and I both saw a little bit of that in person when we saw them, because you saw them against the Spurs and in that surprising early season game. I saw them against the Wolves, and they just have these moments. They have a lot of good players, and there was a moment in this game where they were playing, I think it was Collison, Garrett Temple, Matt Barnes, Omri Caspi, and I think it was Kufos. And it's like, oh yeah, that's a reasonable lineup. And against a team like Brooklyn, that's more than enough to be good.
So I think their over-under, I want to say, was 22.5. I had the over. Do you think they make it?
I always get worried with hamstring injuries. Like, if Jeremy Lin played, let's say he played in 45 or 50 games the rest of the year, I would say they would, but I worry that he's not going to play that, so I'm going to go under.
Yeah, well, they at least are pretty conservative about injury management with this team, which is nice. Yeah, it's getting to where the magic of, hey, we're just going to take a million threes is kind of not really working as much anymore, and you see a game like tonight and you're like, oh yeah, they're starting like one, maybe like 1.5, like NBA starting quality players between Brook and Bogdanovich maybe being the half. I did want to ask you, though, the question, Brook Lopez has been killing it so far offensively. Obviously, he has his defensive limitations. Do you think that he, and also he doesn't play as many minutes maybe as some other guys, but do you think he is the best offensive center in basketball? Like, among like true centers, not, you know, we're not going to count Anthony Davis.
It's between him and DeMarcus Cousins at this point. Towns, I expect.
Well, because he's a power forward now, according to Tom Thibodeau.
He's a power forward now. And also,
count him as a center anymore.
Towns hasn't realized it as consistently. Like, he has all these amazing tools, but we don't see it enough. Whereas with Brook Lopez, like, he does all this stuff night in, night out. I would still go with DeMarcus Cousins because his physicality, and also I trust him more like on the offensive glass, which is a nice aspect for a true guy to have. But Brook Lopez adding the stretch ability, you know, being able to take and make threes, makes this a much closer call than it ever would have been before.
Yeah, that's really what's added to it. You do make the point. He's not any good on the offensive glass. He really is at 6.3% of offensive rebounds, which I think would be a career low, because as you noted, he's spacing out a little bit more. And maybe you could put DeAndre Jordan in that conversation too, but who knows how good he would be on a team.
But like he doesn't have the varied game that Brooke does. Like right. DeAndre is amazing at what he's asked to do, but he can't really do much else at least at this point. And you know, you don't want him posting up. And Brooke Lopez, I think he wouldn't be able to do everything DeAndre does, but DeAndre couldn't do his job at all.
Yeah, you could put DeAndre Jordan in that conversation and then dismiss him as you just did. Boston, 9-7, 4-3 since we last checked in on them. They have gotten healthy again now. Al Horford and Jay Crowder are back. They were 30th in defense about this time a couple weeks ago. Now they're up to 16th and ninth in offense too. I think that they can get to be close to a top five defense if they keep playing well. Although Olynyk, Tyler Zeller, like those guys are kind of the weak links, and Isaiah obviously as well. How are you feeling about them now? Is everything good? I mean, they had that close loss at home to the Spurs. I haven't had any other bad losses. I mean, I think they're kind of, I'm not worried about them still.
No. Worried about it. You know, they lost to the Warriors. That was their only other really recent loss, and there's no shame in that, especially because that was the game before Crowder and Horford returned. So after that, their only loss is to the Spurs. They've been playing reasonably well. Thomas has been a more consistent overall offensive force than he had been in the past. You know, immense talent, but just being able to do more in terms of basically carrying this team offensively himself. And now he has a lot more help. I'm excited to see what their offense becomes in like 2 or 3 months, because Thomas and Horford could really work well. And they have imperfect supporting pieces at power forward, but a lot of the rest of their team is incredibly talented and makes a lot of sense.
I will say that Avery Bradley and Isaiah Thomas are probably going to take a little bit of a step back. Thomas has already begun to do that. You know, he was in like 65% true shooting. Now he's down more closer to his career norms in the high 50s. Still, obviously, an excellent player. Avery Bradley is averaging 18 per game in 36 minutes. So that level of scoring, not something we've really seen from him before. Him being their second leading scorer has been getting to the basket a little bit more aggressive, looking for a shot. I don't know how well that can continue, but I think it's maybe fair to say that he's reached a new level at least so far. Isaiah also has been unbelievable in the clutch. When I looked at it a couple days ago, 46% usage, 64% true shooting, and Boston at that time was 6-2 in the clutch. I think they lost that one to the Spurs, but Thomas at that point had 41 points in 31 clutch minutes. He also only plays 33 minutes a game, which is less than a lot of big stars do. I think the reason for that is just he has such a huge load on offense. And Greg Popovich said, once they got the SportView data, for example, that they realized that Tony Parker was working so hard on offense in their system with a lot of movement, the same way that Thomas does, sprinting off all these dribble handoffs and stuff, running all these pick and rolls, that, you know, they had to play him less minutes because he just doesn't have that much energy for defense. And Thomas, he's so small that if he doesn't have the energy to fight on defense, he's going to get lit up. Like, he's got to fight hard, front in the post, you know, not let the teams post him up, that kind of stuff. So I think that's why he doesn't play quite as many minutes. What else you got to say on these guys?
Something that I hadn't really caught, but I think it was the Boston announcers when I was watching one of their games about a week ago mentioned, is that Avery Bradley has basically doubled his career high rebound rate so far this year. A lot of that is coming on the defensive glass. It has been a more concerted effort from him. And it can really help when you have a team that has, we talked about it last year with the Hawks, that has big men that aren't necessarily using that as their defensive strength, to have a guard come in and help. You know, it can hurt your transition offense, and Bradley has embraced that, and it has helped their team immensely.
Yeah, that's been good. Gerald Green has not helped their team immensely. He's shooting 31% from the field. You remember that they moved on from RJ Hunter basically to keep him. Now Hunter, they're going to deny his option anyway for next year, likely because they feel like they need all the flexibility they can get. I don't think that's like some huge loss. Green would probably still give him more than Hunter would this year, but nonetheless, he has not helped at all. They probably should just give those minutes to Jaylen Brown. If Gerald Green isn't making shots, he's not doing much for you. And then Marcus Smart still has not taken the big leap we hoped for. Again, he was derailed by an ankle injury early in the year, but not too severe. He is doing more playmaking, as a 20% assist rate, assisting on 20% of their baskets when he's on the floor. That's good. But a guy who got to the foul line a ton, got to the rim a ton in college, still not getting to the line at all, and shooting only 42% at the rim. His 33% from three, that's actually, for what he is, that's actually not bad if he can keep that up. But he's just got to find a way to either get fouled or shoot a higher percentage at the rim. And one of the things, too, is you'll see a lot of times, these guys, Rose being another one, if you drive a lot and you don't get to the foul line, you're probably going to shoot a bad percentage at the rim. Because if you think about it, you drive to the rim, when you get fouled, that basically turns a miss. It takes it off your ledger. If you don't get fouled in that play, now it's a really hard shot and you're going to struggle to make those type of shots. So that's what, part of why getting to the foul line is so important, is because when you don't get to the foul line, the shot that you take when you're not getting fouled is probably going to be a miss.
Is it time to make the comparison to another Oklahoma State player who was drafted by the Celtics?
Oh no, who is this?
Tony Allen.
Offensively
capable player who could never really reach that level as the pros, but created an identity as a versatile, forceful defender, and might even find that success on a different team than Boston.
Yeah, Marcus will at least take three-pointers.
Sure.
He's not
the defender Tony Allen is.
Yeah, that's true. I agree. There are a few like Tony Allen, to be sure. All right, let's get to Atlanta. 10-7, but a mere 3-5 since we last checked in on them. 21st in offense, but first in defense. 73% chance at the playoffs. One of the things that showed up to me is that per the SportView data, as of a few days ago, they were leading the league in paint touches per game. And that's passes into the paint from outside the paint. And a lot of those are these Paul Millsap, Dwight Howard post-ups. But those are good post-ups, right? You want those where you're catching the ball with a foot in the paint, and Millsap and Howard are doing a decent job of that. And they're also leading the league in the number of passes out of the post as well.
I don't know if I feel like their offense is sustainable. It's just a weird, like, they have a lot of good players.
Well, they're 21st.
That's true. You have these moments with them, and I don't know if it's just me, but every time Dennis Schroeder takes a three, especially when it's a pull-up, my brain just starts screaming no, and he does it way too
well. He has to take that shot, though, if they're going to be effective.
He doesn't have to take the pull-up three all the time. He can take it more within the
pull-up. They're going to go under on him. That's the strategy. I think he has to make that shot. Maybe he
has to make
it.
I agree with you there.
Yeah.
And Kyle Korver's not shooting enough catch and shoots. You noted in kind of the prep that he's only shooting 3.4 for a game, which is 45th in the league. Some of that is opportunity, but some of it is also just not finding him when he has the chance.
Yeah, and they don't have, still Millsap, Howard running a pick and roll with Schroeder that you can go under on. They just do not have the ability to draw two defenders to the ball the way some of these other teams do. And obviously Korver is someone that they stick to, makes things a little bit easier. But if they had someone who actually could like make you leave him, it would be much better for their efficiency. And, same as when they had Al Horford and Jeff Teague, the big bugaboo here is just not having those guys who can go one-on-one. That Lakers game today, they couldn't score against one of these worst defenses in the league, the Lakers, because they were switching and then they just didn't have anyone who was able to score on them. And the starting lineup in particular has been really bad. And the point guards have been really bad. The starting lineup is a negative 12 net rating going into Sunday. And then Schroeder, he is not doing well in the box score stats, which he used to do. He only has a 13 PER, and he's 75th in RPM among point guards. That is really bad. And it's too bad because I think some of these other guys are doing well. Like, they have a lot of wing guys. Mike Muscala has put on some more weight. He looks like a completely different player than he did his rookie year when he would just get steamrolled in the post every single time. Tabo Sefolosha is shooting very well. He's having one of his better seasons. Tim Hardaway actually has now become a capable rotation player, at least early on in this season. I'm not ready to say declare victory for the Hawks yet in that trade, but he at least has been doing okay. He obviously can be a free agent, which is part of the equation too. And then even Malcolm Delaney, he's not really someone who can get to the basket at all. He'll like shoot a mid-ranger. You have to guard him there, but that's about it. He'll play hard on defense. He's a smart player, but he's only in the 50s in RPM too. They're turning the ball over a ton. I think they are both, I want to say they're number one in both turnovers forced and turnovers committed, in terms of the rate. Just a lot of weird things about this team, but I'm not sure that this offense can get much better.
I'm not either. And while he's not really a part of their offense, Tiago Splitter is out 6 weeks with a calf strain. And when I saw that, I was thinking about how both of us were so positive about that from Atlanta's perspective. He was a salary dump in the process of getting LaMarcus Aldridge, which was actually something we did in the mock off season. I was the Spurs and traded away Boris Diaw instead. But the Hawks got him for nothing.
Memories.
The Hawks got him for nothing. He only played in 36 games last year, and he might even play in fewer this year.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. And 6 weeks with the calf strain, he had that history of calf strains. That was one of the things that sunk them in that 2015 playoffs against the Clippers, was that he missed time with that. He had a million of those. That's why the Spurs moved on from him. And I mean, it's concerning that it's always like some kind of a muscle injury with him. There's the groin first. He's working back from that, tries to ramp up, and then he gets this calf strain. I think they're okay without him, though, considering there's no way he's going to play as well as Muscala has. Now, if they have suffered a Dwight Howard injury, they could be in big trouble too. And they also, Paul Millsap, part of this, I think, is because he has Howard in there kind of taking up some of his preferred real estate. But also part of it is just because he's 32 years old. His efficiency has declined quite a bit. He's now below the league average in his efficiency, only a 17 PR. It's way below where he's been these last couple of years. And then Kent Bazemore as well has not been shooting the ball well. Shot well tonight, but had been 4 of 26 over his last four games before that.
Well, and those are two guys that really benefited from having a floor spacing five, you know, having Al Horford there who forces defenses to handle everything differently. And of course, going from Teague and Schroeder to Schroeder and Delaney hasn't helped either.
They definitely missed Teague, like, despite the fact that we didn't like that acquisition that much for Indiana just because of who they're trading away. I think Teague is still a quality point guard, and despite his rough start to the year, he's still better than Schroeder. And so, yeah, they got the number 12 pick with Prince. He's not quite ready yet either. He has to be told where to be a lot. He does when you see him out there on rare occasions, and he might help them at some point here. But you know, the idea that this team with that 8-2 start, they had that great win at Cleveland, the idea that they were going to be like a powerhouse this year, I think, you know, that first in defense, we shouldn't sniff at that, but I don't necessarily see them getting to be an above average offense. So I think they'll be a solid playoff team. They'll get back home. They'll look a little better, but I don't see them being like a big threat, necessarily even to be in the top three in the conference when it's all said and done.
I like watching them on a game in, game out basis, and they are a nice test case offensively for the difference between a floor spacing five and a talented, Dwight's having a very good year, but a talented but very different traditional five.
All right, we done here?
I think so.
Yeah, that was a marathon. All right, don't forget about our sponsors, Helix Sleep. HelixSleep.com/capspace is the URL to get $50 off your custom made mattress. And then the SeatGeek app, $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via the capspace code. Also, follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Thanks to everyone who's given us an iTunes review or rating. That's always helpful as well. And we're going to be back with the Twitter NBA show this week, Thursday, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty stacked slate.
Yeah, Cavs and Clippers, and then Warriors-Rockets. Really interested to see that Warriors-Rockets game. We are so dedicated to the Twitter NBA show that we're actually going to not go to Oracle, and we'll do the show instead for you guys. So make sure to tune in for that and to dunk on all week long as well. Talk to y'all soon.